Writers observe things. It's just part of what they do, what they choose to observe. Now, that's where writers differ from each other. Our guest this hour chooses a wide variety of subject matter for his shorter essays. Sherlock Holmes and strippers, Siamese twins, and little girls with Southern accents all get attention in the book by Matt Geiger called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. The title comes with an asterisk. Follow that and you see an explanation. Your astonishment may vary. Matt Geiger did not rest long on the laurels for his first book, The Geiger Counter, which won some prizes and just missed a few more. He has won awards for his journalism and even for axe throwing. Matt reports an abnormally high percentage of Neanderthal DNA. Matt Geiger, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me on.
But you are not the Matt Geiger who played in the NBA, right? That's the first thing you got to, when people Google you, this is what they're going
to
get.
They'll have to dig a little deeper in the Google search results to find me, because he'll show up first, certainly.
You have had some fun with the name share, though, even in one of the stories in this book.
Yeah, I did. And so that basically started when I was in middle school, when I found out that someone who shared my name, Matt Geiger, spelled the same way, had been drafted into the NBA. And it didn't seem like it would come up that much, but actually it sort of has, especially when my first book came out and my publisher had me sign up for Google Alerts, which means I just kind of get a daily ding on my phone or email, and then a story about, the NBA in 2001 or advanced basketball analytics or underrated players from the 90s or something. And I try to have a little fun with it, but the fact of the matter is that story is the first in the book, and there's a tiny element of kind of cubism in there where that's a theme that's going to pop up again and again in the essays about the things that link us together. And those things in that story and in many of the stories are death and words. So
those are big things that link us.
Yes.
You're kind of hard on yourself, I noticed, that in comparing yourself to the other Matt Geiger. But, you know, honestly, isn't you know, regularly losing your car keys still preferable to losing millions of dollars, as he apparently has?
Well, I'd like to have the millions of dollars and then lose it. Didn't Dorothy Parker say, you know, people say that, you know, having money isn't that great, but just let me try, you know, give me a shot. Having lost the money would mean at some point I had a shark tank in my house, even though it got repossessed, you know. But, yeah, I mean, we all have our ups and downs, and he followed the narrative arc that so many pro athletes do, you know, where you sign your contract and then you get your tiger and your helicopter and then all gets repossessed in the end.
So then this gets us into a discussion of looking for other people who share names with famous people. You were sent to find the other Johnny Depp?
Yeah, that was a while back, and it was interesting. It was a magazine that was doing a piece about people all over the country who shared names with celebrities. So, you know, the George Clooney who lives in Tallahassee, Florida, or the John Depp who lived in Wisconsin or something. And it is something that all writers think about and play with is these symbols that they exist independently of the things they represent, right? I mean, we come and go, people, and love and death and hate and all these things and beauty are all real, but we have these symbols we use for them, and we can, just using the symbol, we can evoke them. We can call them up and kind of conjure them. Alan Moore, the writer, talked about, you know, that a spell is simply the spelling out of a powerful word. And that's kind of what I'm getting at there. And there's this person, every single person that meets them thinks of someone else the first time they meet them just because of two words.
Oh, right. Yeah. So have you ever talked to the other Matt Geiger?
No, I tried to reach him, and I talked to his twin brother, Mark. He was really nice, really sweet guy, but I left a message. I never heard back from him, so.
Huh.
But he, you know, we're linked. Whether or not we ever meet or talk, there's something between us. And I do like, you know, I love this idea. Obviously, someone who shares your name is not technically your doppelganger, but, you know, this idea of the other that's somehow linked to you is very interesting. And that's a lot of the stories are looking for links between us and other people. That's what the Neanderthal thing is about. That's what many of the stories are about. And the name one seemed like a good way to start it off. And it does, I don't want to give anything away, but it rounds out the book at the end too. So, but
explain the Neanderthal DNA, because this is something you included in your own bio.
Yeah. So many people these days are doing DNA tests, because every single human being alive, however 7 or 8 billion people, we all we're trying to find and create identity, right? And the DNA test is one of the many ways we can do that. Language is another. And I did mine, and I found out I have a lot of Neanderthal DNA. It varies depending on how many people have been tested, but more than 80-some percent of the people tested. But I find that to be kind of beautiful when I started thinking about it, because we have this narrative that certainly is justified in many ways about how bad we are at getting along as a species, right? Uh-huh. Everyone hates everyone else, and we're divided up into these groups, you know, cultural or political or along age lines or gender or whatever. And when I thought about the Neanderthal DNA, the DNA of such different peoples mingling together, it drove home the fact that, yes, we have trouble getting along, but we also come together again and again and again throughout history. And that's how our DNA gets all mingled up, and that's why so many of these people who are having their DNA tested are finding out they have ancestors from all over the planet. And that is that. I think that's beautiful.
So does life, I mean, there's a lot that gets profound in the book, but I also get the sense that life cracks you up. I quickly get the sense from your writing that you're often amused.
Yeah, well, that is the theme of the book in many ways, and it's something I strive for. When I sat down to write this one, I put down a quote by Borges, and it's from a story, and it's talking about this culture in which the philosophers don't seek truth or even an approximation of it. What they seek is amazement or awe, depends on the translation. But and I think there's that bumper sticker, you know, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention.
Right.
And in 2018, I don't think that's true. I mean, I think it's really easy to be outraged. You barely have to pay attention to be outraged by all the terrible things going on and all the injustice and ugliness in the world. I don't think you have to pay attention very carefully to be outraged. But I think to see the beauty and humor around us, perhaps we do need to pay attention and really look. And that's something I try to do in the stories. Because...
All right, let's pick up on the other side of the break. More beauty and humor, because there's lots of that in the book.
Sure.
It's called Astonishing Tales. Your astonishment may vary. Matt Geiger on the Jefferson Exchange, back in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the writer Matt Geiger, whose first book was called The Geiger Counter, got him a bunch of plaudits and a couple of awards. He's followed it up with another collection of stories and essays called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. There's an asterisk at Astonishing Tales that leads to an explanation that says, your astonishment may vary. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jf@jeffnet.org. Matt, you have a preschool-aged daughter, is that right? You have to have a sense of humor then, don't you?
That is correct, and they certainly help with that in many ways.
I like that the story when she walks in with... she was two when she was using a drill was the first reaction I had.
Right, right. Well, it was a toy drill, but it sounded exactly like a real power drill, yes, while my wife was trying to do yoga, which is it's not the most conducive noise when you're trying to do yoga.
No, and I do love your description of the yoga pose as warrior, downward dog, inside out, bonobo. I mean, you should put your additional poses out there on the web for people to add
right.
to. So how back to your daughter then, Hadley. How old was she when she started speaking in a drawl? And you live in Wisconsin, don't you?
Yeah, we do. And she's never really been south. I used to live down south for a while, but she's not been south. And she, it was around then when she was about two, right? She was just starting to speak. And then randomly, she would just come out with this drawl from time to time. And I mean a really thick, syrupy southern drawl, kind of like that, you know, some portly sheriff in an old TV show or something. And we never really figured out where it came from precisely, but kids are, you know, every species has its thing, right? We're adaptive. Every living thing is adapted to be alive and to carry on as a species. And, you know, giraffes have long necks and cheetahs are fast, and we're a story species. We're a narrative species. That's our thing. That's how we share feelings and knowledge and ideas. And so when you watch a little baby lion, when it plays and it's stalking a leaf of grass or a piece of grass or a leaf or something rather, it's playing and it's preparing for what it's going to do as an adult. And kids play with language. And that's something that I very much enjoy, and I think most parents that I talk to, it's one of their favorite things about having a little kid is the way they play with language and open it up for you and certainly give you a few laughs along the way.
Which is a great lesson because, you know, if any parent is paying attention, they're going to learn as much from their kids as their kids learn from them.
Certainly, and they'll, the first thing a kid will teach you when they start speaking English is that English makes absolutely no sense, right?
True.
Because they ask you, there's a little thing in that same story, actually, you know, when I'm trying to, you know, the plural of this word is put together differently than the plural of that word, and on and on and on. And that's a very good reminder, right? Because the first step toward any kind of enlightenment is being like Socrates and kind of knowing that you don't know much. And kids are good at reminding us of that. And they're good at, you know, that you talk about the title of the book, Astonishing Tales, Your Astonishment May Vary. They're good at being astonished because they're really seeing things for the first time. And that is when you see things best, the first and last time, right? Those are the special times when you see anything, the face of a loved one or anything like that. And they're seeing it for the first time, so they're really looking. As adults, we go on an autopilot because we have to find the car keys and we have to get to work and we have to, you know, get all this stuff accomplished, or at least we think we have to get all this stuff accomplished. But to be with a young kid is to see someone really seeing things for the first time, and you can kind of go along with them a little bit and see it too. And that's one of the underlying methodologies of all these stories is there's no English word for it, but there's a Russian word called astronomy, and it's something Chekhov did a lot, and it kind of means to defamiliarize yourself, to disrupt your habitual perception of the world so you can see things better as if for the first time. And kids help you do that, and stories help you do that.
Make you stop taking things for granted. In other words, see what's actually there in front of you.
That's right.
We meet Hadley in a tale about Easter eggs, and I gather Easter's not a central holiday in your house.
No, but is that because I say in the story I don't know when it falls?
Right, exactly. It is hard to remember, though. It's like there's a name for the full moon that I hadn't heard before that you bring up here.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on most of the time, and that's just another example. The Easter egg story is one I like a lot, and that I should just plug Sunlight Press. That first appeared in Sunlight Press, which is a wonderful online literary magazine. But that story is about, you know, when you're an adult, you just fall into these ruts of you have these ideas about how things have to be. And my daughter asked me, we made Easter eggs on Easter, painted them, boiled them, and painted them, and everything. And then, you know, I just automatically said, oh no, we can't. We have to wait like another 12 months. To do that again. And I thought, what am I talking about? Of course we can make Easter eggs, you know? So we have eggs, we have dye, like, we have time. And that's just seeing it differently again, right? Seeing it a little bit strangely, so to speak.
Truly. The book is called Astonishing Tales, Your Astonishment May Vary. Matt Geiger is the author here on the Jefferson Exchange. And it really is a sweet little piece, the one about Easter eggs. You teach her about verbs and toilets, as you explain here, and she was teaching some things in return.
And so many of the things that govern our lives are these vestiges of rules that used to exist to prevent or end problems that we no longer have, you know. And that's something important to remember. And it's just one of the small lessons. I don't claim to have a comprehensive understanding of the world. That's something I learned from Chekhov as well. Anyone who kind of says that they have a simple system for understanding all the people in the world and all the ideas in the world and all the feelings in the world is maybe oversimplifying or possibly trying to sell you something. But I think little moments of insight like that Easter egg thing are possible for all of us, you know, and those, then I think they transcend all those other barriers we put up between ourselves as people.
You give some more general thoughts on parenting in a piece called The Cave, and I'm going to guess that parenting was harder than you might have thought it was going to be.
Yeah, well.
As everybody tells us.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, I've certainly never. I love being a parent. It's the thing I've enjoyed most in my 39 years. But I've never heard anyone say like, "Yeah, I had some kids and I thought it would be hard, but it turns out it's just really easy." You know.
So, have you met anybody who both thought they had parenting knocked and were right?
Well, I mean, all your conversations with other parents are about the things you worry you're doing incorrectly as parents, right? Like, I let her do this thing. Do you think that was okay? Or I didn't let her do this thing. Do you think that's okay? And that piece is about the Chouvet Cave, where there are these ancient tracks that got, you know, that were made in mud and got frozen in time, and it was a little kid and his wolf dog, and they know he had a torch because, you know, you rub a torch on a wall or a ceiling to make it burn brighter, mm-hmm. and it prod the flame further, and they could see where he did that, and they could tell by the way, the size and width of his feet, that it was a little boy, and they could tell it was a wolf dog, and I say wolf dog because dogs weren't fully domesticated yet. That's how long ago this was. Mm-hmm. But they could tell that they were walking, not running, right? So it's not like the wolf was chasing the boy or something. And I love prehistory in particular. You watch a documentary about some new fossils they found or a cave like this, and it's all very neat. And then you have these little moments where you realize that was real. That was a human being with parents who were probably back in their hut going like, you know, do you think 7 or 8 is too young to have given him a torch and let him go off in a cave with his wolf dog or something. And I'll bet even back then, even with all the megafauna of that ice age, I'll bet parenting was still parenting. And I'll bet there were still, they didn't call it helicopter parenting or free range parenting, but I'll bet there were still debates about it and worries about it because we love our kids. That's what we do, right?
You write also of the English literature professor you had who thought about whispering to the child's crib. Did it actually bear any success?
Yeah, it did, and that's one of those things that's magical thinking, right? But that he's a brilliant, wonderful professor, and he'd say, I'm not reading it right now, but he'd say, you know, you'll be smart, you'll be happy, you'll be fulfilled or successful or something like that. And someone asked him whether it worked, and he said, yeah, of course, he is. And correlation is not causation, but I love that type. I think magical thinking is kind of wonderful in many ways, and I like that. And that's in the story about the woman who's on the cover of the book, actually.
Is that the woman who's the stripper?
Yeah, she was a pinup model and a burlesque performer, and
Bonnie Logan, right?
Yeah, Bonnie Logan. She was one of her many names. And she was at my the book launch that we had just the other night, actually. And she's 83, and she signed a bunch of books with me. And she's a dear friend now, but she's a great example. And this is one of the themes in the book. And you know, it's not just about astonishing things; it's about the capacity for astonishment and trying to be astonished. And she's lived a very exciting life, and she's getting older. You know, she's in her 80s, and she has a walker, and most people who see her in the grocery store barely even see her. They probably just kind of marginalize her as a quote-unquote little old lady and think, oh, that's it. You know, they don't think anything else of it. And someone pointed her out to me once and said, you should ask her about her life. And I asked her if she would tell me about her life because I'm a writer, and of course I'm going to do that. And we went and had pancakes and coffee, and it ended up stretching into multiple sessions, and we became good friends. But this quote-unquote little old lady sat down with me, and she had this big plastic shopping bag full of photo albums. And all the photo albums are full of these old pictures of her in all these kind of gaudy, garish, colorful, splashy men's magazines from the 50s and 60s. And she's topless, and she's strangling a man in one or drinking a martini in the other. And, you know, the point of the story isn't, I don't want to ignore that her life in many ways was really rough. I mean, she was in a time that was where sexism and misogyny were just rampant, in an industry where they were particularly rampant. But she was a farm girl who walked out the door as a teenager and said, I'm going to go be a star, and was. And then she came back to Wisconsin, and now she sings in the church choir and everything. And the point is that she lived, even in an imperfect world, she lived an amazing life, a fulfilling and meaningful life. And that's something we all want to teach our children, right? We want to fix the world, but you'd think I was crazy if I told you the world will be fixed by the time my 4-year-old daughter grows up, right?
Right.
It will still be imperfect, but I want her to lead a life that has real meaning, and I want her to see beauty, and I want her to be amazed.
Matt Geiger's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His collection of essays is called Astonishing Tales. Your astonishment may vary. Wanted to ask about the essay actually called Astonishing reveals that you thought you were Sherlock Holmes as a kid. But
really
not
did.
So much, eh?
Yeah, I'm not. We do that whenever we read. That's one of my favorite things about reading books, right, is I'm reading a book by, a man or woman who's been dead for 300 years or something, and I think I'm them. You know, I think I'm the narrator or the protagonist. And when I was a kid, I used to read Sherlock Holmes a lot, and I always thought, yeah, I'm a lot like him. You know, he's so clever. He really sees things. And there's a point when I realized that I'm a lot more like Watson than Holmes. I'm not that smart, but I am astonished a lot, and that's something Holmes says over and over in those books. everything out of Holmes' mouth, Watson replies, you know, astonishing or something like that. And when I was a teenager, I thought that was because he was an imbecile. And then you get older and you learn that you don't know more. There's just more to know. And you start to realize that being amazed is perhaps even a sign of enlightenment in some ways. And that's what that's about.
Then Holmes might have been the smart one, but he was also jaded. And Watson was the one who could still be astonished.
That's exactly right.
So we move on to this next piece, though, about a horse baby, where nobody's ever made slipping and nearly dying in the shower quite so funny.
Oh, well, thank you. Oh, high praise.
can you read a chunk of that? I know you, it was one of the ones you'd set aside as a possible excerpt.
Yeah, let me grab the book here. I picked an extra slippery sweater this morning, which is a mistake. The phone's kind of maneuvering around.
Oh, yeah. If it goes clunk, we'll know what happened.
Yeah, I apologize for that, much to my chagrin. I'll have to remember that next time. Okay, horse baby. And yeah, this one's not too long, so just cut me off if I'm going too far.
Okay.
My daughter loves to empty all the shampoos, conditioners, and soaps when she takes a shower. It's not the monetary loss that bothers me. The problem, and you already know this if you have ever stepped naked into an oblong porcelain bowl in which every square inch has been coated in slick hair conditioner, is that it's probably how I'm going to die. My ancestors were Vikings, proud Celtic warriors. While I'm not precisely sure how one earns entrance through the gates of Valhalla, I suspect slipped on lavender-scented goo does not qualify as dying with honor. It's always the same. You set one foot in, then lift the other into the air, at the exact moment you realize your first foot has refused to stay put, like a wanderlust-filled air hockey puck near a gusty window, perpetually floating in erratic directions. You quickly plant your second foot, with additional force in the tub. Rather than stabilizing you, this simply amplifies the initial problem. And as you go down, you grab a shower curtain, which is also coated in conditioner, and a big, plump fistful of air that, although it is not coated in anything slippery, is an apathetic god who refuses to come to your aid in this time of terrible need. Lying there, covered in slime like some sci-fi space traveler emerging from a time travel pod, you remember that getting up is actually the most difficult part of this ritual. So you lie there, blinded by a stream of water from above, and you marvel at the chaos in your life. Is this normal? Do I have what it takes to make it through another day? Do I have what it takes to stand, to walk, to run? Eventually you rise, and you stand there like a newborn foal, wet and on quivering legs, feeling the gravity of an entire planet on your back as you wait for the last of the conditioner to swirl down the drain. This is how you start your day. This is how you orient yourself to the world. This is your default setting. Naked and afraid, surrounded by empty plastic bottles, as the last of the water slides down what has to be the most vigorously lubricated drain on the planet. To make matters worse, you know you will reek of lavender or coconut oil for days. You are the adult in the house, and this is where you are, stripped of your dignity and everything else, as you wonder if you have what it takes to cultivate and maintain a good and meaningful life. A life in which everyone is relatively well-fed, relatively clean, and relatively alive. It all falls on you, you worry, and you can't even maintain order in a bathtub, let alone your entire home, or the big, menacing, broiling world outside it. The emotions flow through you, first confusion, then anger, then frustration, then wild, exuberant laughter, as you remember that this is not a rehearsal for something else. This is actually it. This is the immense, pressing reality of your life. As we find ourselves out in the world under those skies and face to face with the anger, self-righteous pedantry, and juvenile bigotry, we are more like that newborn foal than we first realized. The one you see drop to the earth, disoriented and covered in the viscous liquid of early life. The one you see rising on unsteady, spindly legs, despite the overwhelming weight of gravity upon its back. I grew up on a farm, so I know what happens next. Because it wasn't the birth that I would rush to see when a baby horse was born. It wasn't the slimy plunge to the dirt below. It was what happened next that captivated me. The thing we rushed to see, and we had to rush because it happened so quickly, was what happened next. The creature would stand uncertainly, and a moment later its legs would stop shaking. It would take a couple steps out into a daunting world. Gravity would relent. The slime dried, and off it would gallop, running, jumping, and frolicking in the sun.
The story is called Horse Baby. It's in the book Astonishing Tales by Matt Geiger. And this is what I referred to as a judo move you pull, where you start with something really funny, like, ha ha, we're going to fall in the bathtub and everybody's slimy. But it turns into this beautiful thing where a horse gallops off into the sun.
Yeah, and that's what I think humor is. I think it's a way in. It's a way into meaning, because the point of books is to open up the world and draw us together. And humor lets you see things in that new way, as we were talking about before. And that's why I at least try. I don't know if and when I succeed, but try to find humor and meaning, you know, greater meaning in some of those small moments, because small moments are what our lives are made up of. Even these people we think of as people from history, you know, all their lives were just made up of a series of small moments. At least they were to them small moments. And that's why I think humor is important.
Much more to talk about with Matt Geiger. Thanks for reading for Horse Baby out loud to us. And we'll come back and talk more about Astonishing Tales with Matt Geiger. And you can join us on The Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to, well, I mean, people have called him a humorist. He's a writer. He just writes lots of short pieces and puts them in books. His last piece was called The Geiger Counter. This one, his collection of stories, is called Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. And there's an asterisk next to Astonishing Tales that says below, your astonishment may vary. And we're talking with Matt on the Jefferson Exchange. And you can join us if you'd like to, if you're moved to comment on something you're hearing here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You really had me laughing out loud at the section of the book, the chapter called Yes, which talks about these magazines like Spree, the big magazine for virile men. You talk about one that practically calls itself Chlamydia.
I do like that, yeah. And I think I say that in their style guide, you know, as a writer, and I'm a journalist too, and we all have style guides we have to follow. And I think I say that in the style guides for these magazines back then, the answer to any query, no matter what it was, any grammatical query, must have simply been to just spell the word with an exclamation point.
Well, which probably explains why this is called Astonishing Tales, exclamation point.
That's correct.
The cover does look, particularly with the picture of Bonnie Logan, and we only see her from the neck up. But this is sort of like those magazines for the pulps from the 50s, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. And that was a cover from one of those. And it's cropped a little more on my book than it was back then. But you know that's the whole thing is about vision, right? This thing that you and I keep going back to in this conversation, and that yes thing. That my favorite passage in the book is the end of that story, and I don't want to. The narrative structure is such that maybe it won't make a ton of sense here, but in the end, my daughter will ask me all these questions, right? And as she ages, the questions will kind of change, and you know, she'll ask if the world is unfair and ugly, and I'll say yes, and she'll ask if it's beautiful and meaningful, and I'll say yes, and she'll probably ask at some point, you know, when she's a teenager, she'll develop that nihilism that we all develop when we're teenagers, right? And she'll say, well, if it all ends, does any of it really matter? And I'll reply with an exclamation point, yes. So.
And I should point out, too, that as we talked about Bonnie Logan, who posed topless for magazines in the 50s and had a really interesting life, and you've become friends, that she gave you a picture to give to your daughter.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. So the Friday we had a little tiny reading and get-together to celebrate the book, and Bonnie was going to be there, and my daughter was going to be there. And just by chance, earlier that day, my daughter was running around the house. Four-year-olds just run around with things. They always have a thing, like, in their hands, and then they discard the thing, and you have to go put it back. This is just life. That's the in the other story I have about the axe throwing competition I won, I'm wearing fairy wings because she discarded her fairy wings because they just, kids aren't capitalists in any way. They don't, nothing has value beyond the moment, which is kind of beautiful. But she just happened, I hadn't told her we were going to go see Bonnie or anything, but she just happened to have that big glossy photo of Bonnie. And Bonnie gave it to me when she found out my daughter had been born and just said, give this to your daughter. And it's a reminder, she's clothed and she's wearing a dress in this particular photo, but it's a reminder to my daughter that everyone has a story and that people live astonishing lives and that she can hopefully too.
You write in the book about a friend who refuses to wear shoes.
Yeah.
I hope he doesn't live in Wisconsin.
He does.
Really?
And he... So that is, he is constantly in conflict with the world. It seems like such a minor decision he's made. Like, who cares? He doesn't like to wear shoes. And when it gets really cold, he wears them. But, you know, he spends a lot of his time barefoot. And it's just every day bringing him into very high-pressure emotional confrontations with people. But people really don't like it. There's something about the foot that's apparently far too intimate for people. They don't want to see it.
Well, and this is the really interesting thing about some of the things you do in your writing is you turn the focus in both directions. So we not only get to hear his reasons for doing it, but we get to see the things that produces in other people, and it can get fairly ugly.
Yeah, it can. I don't know if I can use the word. No, I probably can't say that part. but he, you know, it's there. This is all conjecture, right? I don't know anything about anything, but. But being barefoot does kind of connect you to the world. And in that story, it's Wisconsin, right? So last winter, I left our garage door open one night by accident. Mm-hmm. And our furnace is in our garage. And it was negative six or -9 that evening and that night. So I woke up in the morning and it was 40 degrees in my house and dropping rapidly. And the reason is because my furnace, the thing that has to heat my house for us to stay alive, had frozen. And I mean, like, was encased in ice because it gives off moisture and everything. I called the furnace repair technician, and he came, and his advice, he looked at it and went, yeah, it's frozen. So you're going to have to, like, get it warmer in here so your furnace can start working. And I thought, well, that's ironic. I don't really know how to do that. But a couple days after that happened, water started gushing into our house from all angles because pipes all over the house had burst. And I stepped into a puddle one morning, barefoot, and that's how I learned I had another burst pipe. But in that story, I write about how connected to what I was by the shock of the water on my feet. You know, we walk around connected to the world. And I thought how my friend, who hardly ever wears shoes, he's always very... He must really be experiencing the earth, you know, as he progresses along. And of course, it's not just about feet. It's about vision, too. It's about being connected to things and not distancing yourself. And that's what that's about.
Here again, experiencing the world, yeah.
Right.
But it's interesting, though, the process you take us through into discovering the burst pipe and getting your bare feet in the water is you hear the dripping sound and realize, oh, wait, it's not raining outside, which I think other people have done, too. It's like, where's that water coming from? Oh, yeah, it's rain. No, wait, that's not rain. Uh-oh.
Well, I thought, you know, I did think at first it was rain, and then it was, once again, it's Wisconsin in February, and it was, you know, negative whatever degrees, and I thought, what a pleasant, we don't hear much rain in the winter, and then I thought, wait a minute, that's not right, and I had the horror movie thing happen where I thought, it's coming from inside the house, and I...
Don't go in the basement.
And I'm really bad, I can only hear out of one ear, I'm deaf in one ear, which means I'm not really bad at locating noises. I know a noise is happening, but I can't really find it. So it's always a real adventure for me when I have to find the source of a noise. But I found it eventually.
Oh,
I
wow.
got there eventually.
You had an expensive winter last year then, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It was great. We did eventually get the house warmed up. But that whole thing, you know, the horror movie thing, and that's what this that's what all these stories are supposed to do, right? Because to use another example, if you read a good horror story, you know, a classic horror, not just shock thrill horror or whatever, but Poe or atmospheric stuff, or watch a Guillermo del Toro movie or something like that. A good one doesn't just make you scared when the monster jumps out on page 74 or whatever. The idea, if something's really scary, it'll make you scared a month later when you have to go into your basement to get something. And I think humor is the same. The idea isn't just to make people chuckle at this line or that line, but hopefully to see funny things more often elsewhere in the world.
Ah, to find them for themselves. So it's not just having your view, but developing their own as well.
Right.
So Matt Geiger, I always like hearing about writers' thoughts on writing, and I've discovered at least a few who are not terribly fond of the process itself. Where do you fall on that scale?
I've heard, who was it? Someone said once, I love having written.
Yeah.
I love writing, though. I really do love writing. I've written, like most working writers, I've written a million different types of things, because when you're a working writer, you tend to take the work. I have a degree in philosophy, so I mean,
this explains much.
I've shoveled a lot of manure and all that, too, literally. But, I like writing. I think writing is the subconscious at work, and Alan Moore, I mentioned Alan Moore earlier, and I heard him once just define a writer.
Did he create Swamp Thing? Is it that Alan Moore?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's the kind of the best kind of lunatic. He's written all sorts of things, and he has a new book that I've read part of called Jerusalem that's, I don't know how many pages it is, but it has to be 20 pounds. It's so long. But he defined once, a writer is someone who writes every day. That's what a writer is.
Hmm.
I'm not a particularly clever person or a particularly skilled writer, but I feel compelled to write every day, and I write every day. And I did, even when I had a toddler running around yelling and stuff, I still, I write every day. And I think it can be painful. And I mean, this book's really short, right? And part of the reason for that is because I do so adore Chekhov, and I was reading Chekhov almost every day while writing this book. And his best stories, I mean, he's transcendently good stories that are two pages long or something. And I wanted to be punchy in that way. There are stories about boxing in the book. I wanted to be kind of like the stories to be a little left hooks or whatever. But it was initially really long. I mean, about half the book got thrown in the trash.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Is that just going to be another book?
No. People always say that. But I cut out my editor cut out the bad bits. So I, if it were another book, it would certainly be an inferior book.
you do write of things, Matt, that I have wondered about since childhood. But when I first read about Chang and Eng, the P.T. Barnum's famous Siamese twins, about what happened when one woke up and the other one didn't.
Isn't that something? That's one of those things that that was a real moment. Once like the child in the cave, that was real.
Mm-hmm.
Those were two real human beings, and they were conjoined twins, and they married two different women, by the way, and lived what they said were kind of autonomous lives, despite sharing a liver and a collarbone, I think it was. But I was at a museum in Wisconsin, and it was a circus museum, and they had a statue of them, and I had that moment staring at the statue when I realized they were real. They were human beings. And one morning, one of them woke up and the other didn't. And, man, I mean, the only silver lining to dying is that you don't have to deal with it. And in a weird way, one of the twins had to deal with it. And that, to me, was, I mean, terrifying, but also enormously compelling. And I wrote that quite a long time ago. That was one of the first stories I wrote for this book. And I later... maybe the funniest book ever written, that I've read at least, is Catastrophic Happiness by Catherine Newman, who is just the funniest, most insightful writer on the planet, I think. But she talks about them too. So obviously they are they're compelling to people.
They really are, and they were when they were alive, and even since. I mean, generations of people have read about them, like you and I, have gone, whoa, that must have been really weird.
Yeah.
by the way, we got an email from Bill, No Town Given. He says, Dorothy Parker, again, is the subject, and he puts the quote in there, I don't like writing, I like having written.
Yeah, there we go.
thank you to Bill for providing Dorothy Parker's name there.
That came full circle, because I think I mentioned Dorothy Parker earlier and then didn't know that was her, so that's great.
It does. See, everything comes back around in a cycle.
Yeah.
You report, Matt, of waking up with almost limitless optimism every day, even Wisconsin in the winter?
Yeah, I do. I like, I don't know what it is, and that story.
You don't live in Green Bay, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I don't. I live near Madison, near
okay,
the capital.
Yeah. We did for 15 months.
But it's, it's grim in the winter here. Mm-hmm. Anyone who tells you otherwise is, once again, probably trying to sell you something, possibly land in Wisconsin. But I get up really early, and I don't know. I think the night is, I mean, I like getting my sleep and everything, but the night can be a weird time, especially to those of us who, like most people, you know, we worry about death or the unknown or whatever. And nights can be long sometimes. And I do think there's this atavistic thing where, you know, we think of the sun is rising as kind of illuminating the world. But in a weird way, I feel like it kind of drops this golden veil over the world and allows us to function without fear again for a few hours.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, that riff on monsters that comes out of Chang and Eng, idea that the daytime is actually the shroud.
Yeah, because the fears are real. But I'm always amazed. Once in a while, I'll talk to someone. I'll be like, well, you know, when you stay up for a few hours some night and you just worry about death, and they'll go like, oh, no, I don't do that. And I think, really? What? Like, what's wrong with you, you know? All that stuff, I think the monsters are real, and I like mythology a lot. I think, you know, stories that aren't literally true about gods and monsters and things are really important. I think they're beautiful, and they help transcend these things that kind of tear us apart. But you can't live with those monsters and gods all the time. You need to get out in the daytime when that veil has been dropped and kind of covered up them and let you live your life.
Right, and realize you have to relate to other people and notice the things around you, all of which are done in abundance in the book Astonishing Tales. It's a series of stories by Matt Geiger. He does put an asterisk next to Astonishing Tales and say your astonishment may vary. Matt Geiger, very much a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
This was great. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Take care.